Atrial fibrillation is a rhythm disturbance of the heart that specifically is a problem with the two upper chambers of the heart. The heart has four chambers. The upper pair of chambers receive blood and push that blood onto the lower pair of chambers, which then compress and push the blood around the body. In the normal heart, the upper chambers beat and contract in an organized fashion, push blood into the lower chambers, in effect to top them up, immediately prior to them contracting and pushing blood out of the heart. Atrial fibrillation describes a scenario where the upper chambers of the heart do not contract in an organized fashion, and rather than a carefully controlled spread of electrical activation around those upper chambers, it is rather disorganized and chaotic, and no consistent signal is developed, and the chambers no longer contract. The upper chambers are electrically isolated from the lower chambers of the heart, except for a very small region, which we like to describe as the heart's junction box, through which the electrical signals of the upper chamber have to travel to reach the lower chamber in order to continue a normal heartbeat. And for this reason, when atrial fibrillation occurs, the regularity of the heartbeat is affected, and rather than the heart beating in a nice regular pattern, it becomes erratic with an irregular pulse, and typically the heart rate is faster than a normal heartbeat. Atrial fibrillation is a very common rhythm disturbance, and in fact it is the most common heart rhythm problem that we encounter. And in reality, almost everyone is potentially at risk of atrial fibrillation because it's usually caused by factors which are common to many people, notably lifestyle issues, being overweight, having high blood pressure, smoking, being diabetic, and having underlying heart disease, such as coronary artery disease, all promote atrial fibrillation, as does another fairly common problem with the heart, which is heart valve disease. And if you have abnormalities of the heart valve that cause problems with blood flow within the heart, that can cause the upper chambers to stretch and enlarge, which can disrupt the organization of the electrical signals and promote atrial fibrillation. However, it's a problem we typically see in people who age, and around 10% of people over 70 will have atrial fibrillation, whereas fewer than 1% of people under the age of 50 will have atrial fibrillation. That's not to say we don't see it in younger people. In people who are born with heart problems or who've had heart surgery at a young age, they are also at risk of atrial fibrillation, and we do encounter patients in their 20s and 30s who develop this problem. It's not just a problem of elderly patients. The most common heart problem we encounter as cardiologists is coronary artery disease, which causes heart attacks, angina, and chest pain. But the second commonest problem we encounter is atrial fibrillation, and many patients who are referred up for further assessment and for further treatment, their primary problem is atrial fibrillation, and whilst it may be a result of coronary artery disease, the problem we're addressing is their heart rhythm disturbance. Atrial fibrillation itself is interesting in that there is a large variety of symptoms that it can cause. In many patients with atrial fibrillation, it causes no symptoms whatsoever. That means the patient is unaware of their pulse being erratic and irregular or particularly fast, and the atrial fibrillation is uncovered unintentionally, perhaps because the patient is having a test for another reason, or because someone stops and takes their pulse, again as part of a routine medical checkup. When younger patients develop atrial fibrillation, they can have quite disabling and significant symptoms, primarily due to the issue that their heart tends to beat at a much more fast and more erratic rate than before. Typically, our heartbeat at rest might be 70 beats per minute, but if atrial fibrillation occurs, where the upper chambers have gone into a very fast rhythm, this can make the heart beat at speeds of around 140 to even 160 beats per minute, which is the same speed the heart would get to if you're exercising very hard. But as you can imagine, if you're sitting still quietly and your heart is beating that fast, it can be quite unpleasant. This can cause additional symptoms such as tightness in the chest, a sensation of breathlessness, a sensation of fatigue, and for some patients, lightheadedness or even blackouts where their heart rate is going so fast that they can't sustain a blood pressure and they faint or pass out. Those are quite unusual and quite dramatic symptoms. For most patients, it's an unpleasant awareness of their heart running fast. Atrial fibrillation isn't necessarily permanent, in that for many patients, their heart rhythm could be normal, and then for reasons we don't fully understand, they develop atrial fibrillation, which can start, perhaps persist for 1 or 2 hours, and then stop, and the heart rhythm returns to normal. And for those patients, we undertake measures to try and stop the atrial fibrillation from happening at all. Some patients, however, will go into atrial fibrillation and stay in atrial fibrillation until we undertake very specific treatment to try and restore a normal heart rhythm. And in some patients, once they've developed atrial fibrillation, it does become permanent, and no matter what we do, they will stay in that heart rhythm. There are two main consequences of atrial fibrillation which can affect some patients. The first is that the speed of the heart in atrial fibrillation tends to be high, and if left untreated, someone's heart will be beating at around 140 or 150 beats per minute continuously. That effectively means the heart is under continued exercise without any chance for rest or respite, and in a small number of patients, that can lead to the heart becoming enlarged and weakened simply as a consequence of the speed it's been working. Now, in the majority of those patients, if the heart is controlled and the heart speed is slowed down, the function of the heart will recover and turn to normal. The second and perhaps the most important consequence of atrial fibrillation is the fact that because the upper chambers of the heart are no longer contracting in a coordinated manner, not all of the blood within those chambers is pushed out down through the valves and into the other chambers of the heart. This means that blood can start to travel more slowly through those chambers, and if it starts to slow down, then blood can start to clot. There are small pockets and crevices within those upper chambers of the heart, and if blood is allowed to slow down and settle within those pockets without being ejected, then very small blood clots can form. Now, if those blood clots stay within the heart, they won't cause any problems. But if the blood clots were to travel out of the chamber and enter the main bloodstream and then travel out through the heart valves and into the circulation, they can cause significant problems, such as a stroke. And if a small blood clot, perhaps no bigger than a grain of rice, travels to the brain and blocks an important artery, the patient may suffer a stroke, which could be quite disabling and affect their vision, their speech, and their movement. And this is where the problem comes, because many patients are in atrial fibrillation but are not aware of it, have never had a test done to check for it, and are therefore not treated, and are at risk of small clots forming and are at risk of strokes occurring. There are measures that patients and the public can take to try and prevent atrial fibrillation. The commonest cause overall for atrial fibrillation is having high blood pressure. The effect of high blood pressure is to put more work on the heart. The heart becomes thicker and stiffer, and that in turn puts more pressure on the upper chambers of the heart, and over many years it can cause those upper chambers to stretch and enlarge. The fine electrical connections within the chamber are disrupted, and the usual coordinated electrical activity fails and atrial fibrillation develops. So measures that can help to prevent high blood pressure developing are key to preventing atrial fibrillation, and typically these are all the standard measures that we should perhaps all undertake, which is regular exercise, regular good physical exercise, avoiding being overweight, have a diet which is balanced and has everything in moderation and nothing to excess, avoiding excessive alcohol, and avoiding smoking. Atrial fibrillation is easy to diagnose. In experienced hands, you simply have to take the patient's pulse, and you'll very quickly be able to determine whether it's a regular pulse, where each beat comes in a predictable fashion, perhaps 1 beat per second, for example, or whether the pulse is obviously erratic, where there is a different amount of time between beats, and the commonest reason for that would be atrial fibrillation. To confirm your suspicion, you do need to do an electrocardiogram, commonly abbreviated to an ECG, which is a test to record the heart's electrical activity. This is performed by sticking 10 electrodes onto the surface of the chest and the wrists and the ankles, and then attaching these electrodes to some cables, which are then attached to an ECG machine, and that records the electrical activity of the heart over 10 seconds and displays this as a graph on a piece of paper. And most of us might recognize the images of a black line traveling across the paper with intermittent spikes of electrical activity, and those spikes refer to the moment when the heart beats. And again, to the experienced eye, it takes just a moment to look at the ECG and determine whether the heart rhythm is normal or whether there is atrial fibrillation present. It also gives you additional information about the general health of the heart, perhaps information about the thickness of the heart muscle, and can give you some clue as to whether certain chambers of the heart are enlarged. It also tells you the speed of the heart, which is quite important as to what treatment you might want to offer, and it can give you some clue as to how long the patient may have had atrial fibrillation for. It's most useful if you have an ECG from a period of time before to allow you to compare and see whether any other additional changes have occurred apart from the new heart rhythm. If an ECG confirms atrial fibrillation, then most patients will go on to have an additional test of their heart, and that would usually be an echocardiogram, to answer the question whether their heart is structurally normal, i.e. they were born with a healthy heart, and whether there is any major structural problem with the heart as a consequence of either coronary artery disease, heart disease affecting the heart valves, or enlargement of the heart chambers. If somebody has a completely normal heart, then treating their atrial fibrillation is quite straightforward. If in fact you uncover that somebody has an underlying heart problem, which might include unrecognized coronary artery disease or a major valve problem, then treating their atrial fibrillation might be more difficult and require more than just medical therapy. One of the challenges in managing and assessing atrial fibrillation is actually proving that that is what the patient was experiencing when they had their symptoms. Some patients with atrial fibrillation will just have short episodes of atrial fibrillation, with their heart rhythm, for all intents and purposes, being completely normal between episodes. The problem here is that an ECG will appear to be normal, an echocardiogram checking their heart function may also be normal, but the symptoms the patient had the week before, when they felt their heart racing very fast, may well have been atrial fibrillation. Now, if we are concerned that a patient may have had an episode of atrial fibrillation, we will make every effort to capture it and record it so we can prove what we are treating. And a simple ECG at rest may not be sufficient, and some patients may be asked to wear a cardiac monitor, which is a portable device where, again, electrodes are secured to the skin and attached to a small box that is worn on a belt. And that is able to record the heart rate for 24 hours, 48 hours, or in some cases 7 days, and allow us to monitor someone's heart rhythm for a prolonged period of time. Now, of course, if a patient has symptoms that happen every 2 or 3 days, we're likely to be able to catch one. However, some patients have symptoms that are very infrequent and perhaps only occur every 2 or 3 months, and it's impractical to record a patient's heart rhythm for that long. In those cases, we may provide the patient with a cardio memo device, which is a small box with electrodes on the surface of the box, and when the patient experiences a symptom of palpitation, when the heart is racing in an abnormal manner, they can hold the box to the skin and press a button, and it will record a very crude documentation of the heart's electrical activity, but it may well be enough for us to look at it on a computer screen and say, yes, this was atrial fibrillation, and understand the rhythm disturbance that's causing the patient's symptoms. It's important to understand and recognize that when we diagnose atrial fibrillation, we have to perhaps go on and try and explain why it has happened. Although atrial fibrillation is the description of the abnormality in the heart rhythm, it is frequently a sign that there is an underlying problem with the heart, either related to the heart structure, or the ability of the heart to function normally, or a clue that there are other heart problems, such as coronary artery disease. Now, if there has been untreated and unrecognized hypertension, and the heart has become abnormally stiff, and the function of the heart is impaired, the first clue that has happened might be the patient experiencing atrial fibrillation. And this is why we'd always go on to check the patient's heart function and structure with an echocardiogram to look for any underlying problem. Another frequently encountered scenario is when a patient presents with symptoms related to atrial fibrillation. However, on investigation, we identify there is an underlying problem with one of the heart valves that's changing the way blood flows within the heart and putting additional strain on the upper chambers of the heart and causing the atrial fibrillation to occur. Now, this is important because if we do find an underlying problem, such as a heart valve problem, it may be more appropriate to treat that as the primary strategy rather than giving medication to control the heart rhythm without treating the underlying cause. And the same is true of high blood pressure. If we find significant untreated high blood pressure, it may be more appropriate to direct treatment towards that in the hope that by controlling the blood pressure, atrial fibrillation may either disappear or become easier to control rather than simply focusing our treatment on the heart rhythm alone. Treatment of atrial fibrillation can range from being extremely simple through to being quite complex and difficult, and it reflects the underlying issue that atrial fibrillation is not similar across patients and can be very different depending on the underlying heart problem, the age of the patient, and for how long they've had their symptoms for. In simple cases, the only treatment required is perhaps a single injection of a drug or a pill to revert the heart rhythm from atrial fibrillation back to normal, and once normal heart rhythm is restored, the patient may not require any ongoing treatment. This scenario might occur in a young patient who develops atrial fibrillation out of the blue, comes into hospital, the diagnosis is made quickly after an ECG, and an injection of a drug is given to try and promote restoration of a normal rhythm, and this is successful in the majority of cases. If that was the first and only episode of atrial fibrillation, the patient could be discharged home with no ongoing treatment, and in a number of patients, they will never go on to have a further episode. Other patients who are found to have atrial fibrillation, if you like, by accident, where it is encountered and the patient has no symptoms, a decision is then made whether to try and restore normal heart rhythm. If a patient is in atrial fibrillation and has good heart function and is asymptomatic, in other words, they are not more breathless than normal, can function without symptoms, then it may be very reasonable to leave the atrial fibrillation well alone and offer treatment just to prevent the risk of stroke and not direct treatment towards the heart rhythm disturbance. Conversely, if a patient presents because of symptoms with atrial fibrillation and appears to have been in it for some time, then restoring the heart rhythm to normal is appropriate. While this can be done with medication, it can also be done very simply with a procedure called a cardioversion, where the patient is treated under general anaesthetic and a very controlled dose of electricity is passed through the chest and through the heart, and the effect of this is to reset the heart rhythm and allow normal heart rhythm to occur. This is an instantaneous treatment in that as soon as the heart is shocked back into a normal rhythm, the treatment is finished. This treatment therefore is only effective in restoring normal heart rhythm. It doesn't help to prevent further episodes of atrial fibrillation. For many patients with recurrent atrial fibrillation, in other words, a tendency to redevelop it even after normal heart rhythm is restored, first-line treatment here is usually medication with drug treatment to try and prevent episodes of atrial fibrillation from developing. In many patients, it's entirely possible to find a drug that suits them and suits their heart and prevents atrial fibrillation from occurring. However, in some patients, it can be hard to find a drug that doesn't cause side effects or does not control their heart rhythm adequately, and they may require more specialist treatment to control their heart rhythm, which might include a specific intervention where small tubes are passed into the heart, and the areas that provoke or cause the atrial fibrillation are then cauterized using heat energy to effectively cause small burns within the heart that prevent the atrial fibrillation from developing. This invasive strategy can be extremely effective, but obviously carries small risks as a consequence of the procedure. An important aspect of managing and treating a patient with atrial fibrillation is to reduce and hopefully prevent the possible risk of stroke as a consequence of clot formation within the heart. This can be quite difficult to explain to a patient because the patient may be very well and you're asking them to take treatment which will not make them feel any better but will prevent things from happening in the future. For some patients, taking an aspirin a day may be sufficient, but these are only really used in patients who are at very low risk of stroke formation, in other words, those who have a healthy heart with no underlying problems. In most patients with atrial fibrillation, there may be an underlying heart problem, a valve problem, or evidence of coronary artery disease, which increases the risk of clot formation and stroke. And in those patients, we would recommend stronger thinning of the blood, anticoagulation, typically with a drug called warfarin. This is a rather complicated drug for patients to take, because the dose is different in every patient and requires monitoring with regular blood tests to ensure the correct dose is being used and that the patient's blood is not too thin and that we are effectively reducing their clot risk. There are newer alternative drugs that are coming onto the market at the moment that are as effective as warfarin in thinning the blood, but do not require blood tests, do not require regular monitoring, and have less side effects. They are, however, more expensive than warfarin, which is an extremely cheap and very effective treatment. You can broadly divide your management strategy for atrial fibrillation into two arms. One of these is termed the rate control strategy, and another is called the rhythm control. If we focus on rate control first, the aim of treatment here is to control the rate of the heart. In other words, stop the heart from accelerating, stop the heart from running too fast, and reduce the consequences of a persistently high heart rate on the overall heart function. This is done by using drugs such as digoxin or drugs like beta blockers, which slow the speed of the heart, return the pulse down to a normal rate, and allow the heart to become more efficient, but the heart remains in atrial fibrillation, and they have no benefit in terms of trying to prevent atrial fibrillation from occurring again or trying to force the heart rhythm back into normal. The alternative strategy is what's termed the rhythm strategy, and this is an approach where the priority is to try and restore normal sinus rhythm and try and stop atrial fibrillation from happening again. And this is achieved through using a different combination of medications which try and slow down the heart but also promote the heart rhythm from returning to normal and hopefully stop further episodes of atrial fibrillation from reoccurring. Another strategy or another technique as part of the rhythm control strategy is to use an electrical shock treatment to normalize the heart rhythm, followed by a drug treatment to try and stop further episodes of atrial fibrillation occurring, or an ablation technique using catheters to actually eliminate the cause of atrial fibrillation in the first place and try and cure somebody and allow them to never have atrial fibrillation again. The most effective and most commonly used drug for atrial fibrillation is a beta blocker. This is a drug which restricts the symptoms from our nervous system that are used to control the speed of the heart and are very effective at slowing the heart down, both at rest and on exercise, but can have troublesome side effects like a sensation of cold hands and feet, general fatigue, lowering blood pressure, and causing someone to feel rather slow and lethargic. Alternatives include drugs like flecainide, which is extremely effective at preventing atrial fibrillation, or a drug called amiodarone, which is a very unusual drug in that it takes many months to achieve effect and takes many months to wear off, but can be effective at again preventing atrial fibrillation. But this is a drug associated with many potentially quite serious side effects and is not used first line. For most patients, our preference would be to start a beta blocker, and if this is not tolerated or ineffective, digoxin can be added alongside the beta blocker to ensure adequate heart rate control.